Welcome back, everyone, to the Bibliotakes podcast, where Cody and myself are continuing our recap and discussion of Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran. Today's our second episode, and we are covering more or less the first half of Chronicle 2, titled The Evidence Man. Cody, how we doing on this fine evening?
You know, I do have a habit of re-listening to our pods after they're published so I can see how it went, see what I liked about it, see what I want to go through, just, you know, doing the work.
Probably good.
But I did that after I read this section and felt a little dumb. We'll talk about it.
Yeah, certain things came to light where it was just a little bit of a head scratcher about some takes we may or may not have had from last week.
We did cover our butts a little bit, and we'll get into it, but that's kind of how I'm feeling tonight. How about you?
No, that's a great call out. And I think it speaks to the way that David Gran wrote this book in a way like a true like mystery narrative. Mm-hmm. Because there are things that obviously he knew the entire time he was writing this book. He's not doing his research one chapter at a time, but he chose to include certain characteristics about certain people, include certain details in a way that fits the actual narrative structure of how our investigation kind of pans out.
Yep.
Which makes this, and I think you mentioned this last week, Cody, yes, it is incredibly sad and very, you know, it's just awful that this happened in real life. But at the same time, is maybe the best like murder mystery story I've read, you know, and we read Agatha Christie. Come on. So anyway, last week we got into the beginnings of the conspiracy around, as the subtitle of this book says, the Osage murders and the birth of the FBI. So basically where we left off last week was around 24 members of the Osage tribe have been murdered. These people are making lots and lots of money from the oil head rights that they negotiated for with the United States government when the United States government tried to enact allotment legislation and take some of their land. So they own all the rights to the oil. They're getting very, very wealthy. And now, slowly but surely, members of this tribe are being murdered. It seems to be connected. The country as a whole knows about this. There's a lot of uproar about it. And so PIs, local police, and soon to be federal investigators are getting involved now in these murders. And that is where we pick up today with Chronicle 2 titled The Evidence Man and Chapter 8 in our book titled Department of Easy Virtue.
1925, we meet FBI agent Tom White, who is an old school badass Texas Ranger who now works for the Bureau of Investigation and has been called to Washington to speak with its new director, J. Edgar Hoover. You may have heard of him. Hoover is a very particular man. He demands that his agents not necessarily look or behave like sheriff's deputies, U.S. Marshals, Texas Rangers, traditional lawmen. Because like Paul had mentioned in the previous section of our reading, municipal police departments had not necessarily existed for a long period of time up to now. There is no kind of idea of what a, you know, lawman should look like, except for those in the cowboy kind of imagination. But J. Edgar Hoover wants FBI agents, because of their position within the federal government, to look very federal. They want them in black suits, lawyerly, specifically hiring lawyers and accountants. But every once in a while, you need to hire people who are local to their field offices. So there's field offices in each state. That includes Western states and relatively recently settled lands that are now states. This includes Texas, where Tom White is from, and Oklahoma, where he will be sent to. A little bit of the background about the FBI. not the FBI at the time, but the Bureau of Investigations at the time, is that during the Harding administration, the feds were extremely corrupt. Remember Teapot Dome that I referenced last time. When Calvin Coolidge came in, probably one of the most underrated presidents we've ever had, just served one term, cleaned up a bunch of stuff, left, didn't want a second term. Pretty funny. He just came in and cleaned house, and Hoover, who is at the time 29 years old, was a deputy director and managed to be promoted from interim director to head of the bureau. Hoover is young. He's a pretty relentless and deviously ambitious person. And I'd like to note that he spoke with a staccato to cover up a childhood stutter. I find that very interesting. I find it interesting when you learn that, you know, famous people from history had these like developmental disorders, just because it shows like you could kind of be anything. George Washington was very dyslexic, to name another example.
Just force of will, get yourself where exactly you need to go. That's
exactly right. Like, yeah. And, you know, I would, you know, warn you not to label body yourself after J. Edgar Hoover, maybe a little bit more like George Washington, but that's neither here nor there. He explains that the Bureau's previous attempts to shirk this Osage murders case have led to a few embarrassments, and the Bureau is new enough that it can just get shuttered. You know, it's a new federal agency. It's pretty unproven at this point, and it's definitely not the FBI that you or I or the dear listener know about it today. So because this case has been really kind of thrown in their laps again, they need to solve it with a very resounding conclusion. And he needs White, an experienced Western lawman, to crack the case. You know, there can be no failure, or Hoover and White and everyone in the FBI could be on the chopping block to lose their jobs. And that's where that chapter ends. Very brief, very succinct, but I found it really cool.
Yeah. And a few things to add to that. One, Cody, you mentioned that the Bureau is at risk of being shuttered. One of the things that I find really interesting about that, and there are still remnants of this today, is like the distrust of municipal police departments, it's even worse for federal police. Mm-hmm. So any kind of like federal oversight, the states are like, we don't want this. Like, why does the Bureau exist? And so there's mention in this chapter of like the Bureau was working with this ex-bank robber to help them with a case. He ended up going kind of rogue, robbed another bank and killed a police officer. It's like, okay, we can't have that in this investigation. Any public scandal could just be disastrous for us. But I also find it interesting that, and this just speaks to the gravity of the situation in Osage County right now, the chapter ends by basically noting White accepts this role as the head of the investigation into the Osage murders and is now a marked man.
Right.
Like, he's going into this knowing full well that this is incredibly dangerous and he might die because other people have before.
You reference at the 24, I believe at the time of this conversation between Hoover and White, 24 Osage who had died, but that doesn't include the handful of random citizens who tried to take it upon themselves to investigate and ended up murdered just alongside them.
Right.
And
right.
Another thing about the kind of, you know, the politics, it's very funny that, like, you know, the states at this time really wanted a middle ground between municipal and federal police. Municipal police, they were worried about, you know, local graft, local unaccountability. And at the top, they were worried about, you know, that, you know, armed police state that could potentially be used as a weapon of the federal government against local municipalities. Here's the thing. That's exactly what Hoover wants. Get there.
Yeah.
Can't get there without credibility and a couple big W's in his, like, you know, on his resume. And so, and I will say at this time, you know, a lot of times bureau agents were not allowed to carry firearms. A lot of times they couldn't even like make arrests. They could just investigative purposes. So really at the beginning here, the Bureau of Investigations is just that. They're just like a detective agency, but from the federal side and not the Pinkerton side. Like, Pinkertons could fuck up all they want. And if you choose not to hire them, that's fine. But the feds are the feds. So that's why there's this big impotence on no scandals. 0000 scandals, because we have to have the public's trust. And, you know, ostensibly, it's to solve this case and save the Bureau, but there's kind of a little bit of Hoover being like, you need to boost your guy.
Mm-hmm.
Me, J. Edgar Hoover. Like, I'm everyone's meal ticket on this train to a federal police state, and you're not going to mess that up for me. So that's where the chapter ends.
Totally. So chapter 9, titled The Undercover Cowboys. So this is 4 years after the death of Anna Brown and Charles Whitehorn now. And Tom White, this detective we just met, is poring over the disorganized case files and is just amazed by the brutality of the murders and the fact that no one tried to this point really talking to Molly Burkhart. The brutality of the murders, and is surprised by that, really shocked me, because Tom White was also, as Cody said, like a badass lawman. He's seen his fair share of like violence in his day. So this really is, you know, if it's enough to shock Tom White here, it's enough to shock me for sure. So when looking at these case files, he's looking at the span of the time of the murders, the varied methods of killing and the locations. All of that indicated that this was not done by one person, but maybe orchestrated by a single person with a certain level of intelligence and patience in order to like organize this whole conspiracy. But we have a problem here. We have too many leads, but not enough evidence that was provided by all of these shady private investigators and just other dudes working on this case. So White is focused on putting all of this together in order to form, quote, an unbroken chain of evidence. So White starts putting together this team of what he calls undercover cowboys. And importantly, this doesn't include his brother, Doc. And the reason for that is because he and his brother have always like worked on separate things so that no two people in the family would die at the same time, potentially. But we get this like Ocean's 11-esque team up. So we have former sheriffs, dudes who are just flatly good in dangerous situations, in former insurance agents. It's like, it's so like Ocean's 11 where it's like, well, what do we need? We need a grease man. We need the pickpocketer from Chicago. We need a couple of brothers who are just like good driving cars.
Dude, I literally wrote down it's Western Ocean's 11.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you texted me. And as soon as I was reading it, I was like, oh, yeah, yeah, this is exactly what that is.
It's even got that kind of action movie, like, you know, Hoover is just like, you know, the big boss who brings in his guy. Like, he's like, I need you to do this job. I can't do it alone. And then, you know, White's like, that's OK, but I'm going to need my guys. And Hoover's like, you got a blank check, White. You just solve the case for me. I don't care what it costs.
It's literally the government going to Dom Toretto and being like, we don't care how, we just need you to get this done.
Dude, which happens in the past four of those movies where they're just like, welcome to the government, Dom Toretto. And he's like, I need my familia.
Sweet. Let me get Ludacris and Tyrese in here. These are the guys for the job.
Exactly. One guy on this posse, his hobbies include shooting, hunting, fishing, mountain climbing, adventures, and manhunting.
In that order, too. I wrote down that quote, Cody, and it just made me laugh because it's like, adventures seem, it just seems a little unnecessary. It's sandwiched in that list of things.
I will say, exactly, it's a little redundant, but I will say, if you met someone who's like, if their Instagram bio said like lover of adventures, you'd be like, whatever. But then if preceding that or following that, it was hobbies include manhunting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's an ultimate like guy you meet at a bar whose job you've never heard of before. Like if you met a guy, he's like, what do you do, man? He's like, oh, I manhunt. What? I hunt men.
I think for my next job interview, I'm just going to put that under special skills and see what they say.
Yeah, dude, like put it in like type like 0.01 font and just see if any like, you know, algorithms detect it.
Like, what is this manhunt? Don't worry about it. Anyway, we also have this guy named John Wren, who was a previous spy for the revolutionary leaders in Mexico. He's an Indian himself, handled a lot of delicate cases on reservations in the past. Anyway, we've got all of these guys who have like a very particular set of skills, teams assembled. Now Hoover sent out a message to everyone, and this is the like action movie shit that I've been waiting for. The message reads, proceed undercover immediately, reporting to agent in charge, Tom White. And then the next line is, White grabbed his gun and set out for the Osage County. another traveler in the mist.
So hard, bro.
Dude, it's so hard.
And that man, Ren, who is native himself and worked cases on reservation, he calls himself Hoover's Brave.
Right. Yeah.
Like a Cheyenne Brave warrior or something. That's so cool.
Yeah. This is begging to be turned into a movie. And luckily it has been.
It has been. Super has been. Yeah. Extremely badass. We're getting the team together chapter, which, you know, I will say we've been dealing with a lot of rough stuff in this book so far and will continue to. It was cool to have a little reprieve of just, you know, straight up action movie shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chapter 10 is titled Eliminating the Impossible. So as our undercover agents get into town, they are establishing their covers. The former insurance agent is like, well, I'm just going to go door to door as an insurance agent, see what I can get. Other guys show up as like different business owners. Ren is undercover as, you know, just a generic Indian medicine man to kind of communicate with the Osage people. White soon finds that the evidence in Osage County is paltry at best, and the fact that the bullet lodged in Anna's skull was never found is particularly weird to him. Now, the Scholl brothers, these doctors claim to have not found anything, and given how many people were at the crime scene, like, it could have been anyone who ended up getting the bullet, maybe, maybe not. It's really hard to say. This crime scene and all the following ones were just completely messed up. And he does a really good job because, like Paul said, there's too many witnesses / too many leads and not enough evidence. So they're just going to methodically go down every lead and just eliminate them one by one. Let's just get all the ones as we can. So Oda Brown and Rose Osage had alibis. They track down a bootlegger who might have info and they convince him to become a criminal informant. And they take his measurements with this extremely weird and like really like antique sounding way of like identifying someone by taking different measurements of different body parts so that if you ever found them again and performed these 11 measurements again, you'd be able to perfectly identify someone. And they also just end up fingerprinting him, which is the new way to just, you'll always get your guy.
Right.
Rose and Joe Allen, they have this alibi and it's backed up by the fact that they said they couldn't have been there for these deaths because they were at a hotel. And there's this call woman who's the one who gave the kind of Rose, who was the originator of this Rose killed them story. And, you know, the facts should be different if this woman is to believe. Like, even the hotel they say that is like, oh yeah, we have record of them staying here. This is completely unrelated to like any of the nonsense going on in Osage County. So it really is hard to kind of see a way out of that. And when they go to this woman and ask her about it, she confesses that she made up the whole thing because a white man came to her house with a pre-written statement and forced her to sign it under, you know, the presumed threat of violence. And they now realize that not only is this evidence bad, like it's been mishandled or it's been, you know, trampled upon or the wrong people touched it, it's been completely manufactured to alter the trajectory of case away from a certain group of people. And that's where the chapter ends.
Right. Yep. It's just a mess. And so we're going to continue along that line of just kind of this very hazy view of things in chapter 11, which is titled The Third Man. We start with Hoover micromanaging everything in the case and even doing his own investigating from Washington. And he believes that there's a white woman married to an Osage man named Nessia Kenny, who might be able to connect the dots between all of these execution style murders. So Kenny, this woman, had made allegations that this guy, A.W. Comstock, who is the guardian, again, like the estate guardian of several Osage people, was part of the conspiracy. Hoover actually interviews her himself twice, and she's been diagnosed by a doctor because she's kind of nuts, but diagnosed by some doctor as just being hyper paranoid. So Hoover thinks that she might be of use in the investigation. Here we kind of cut to the end of July 1925. And White has turned his attention to Molly's brother-in-law, Brian Burkhart. He was at a musical the night of Anna's murder, he maintains. And this alibi is corroborated by Brian's aunt and uncle, who were apparently with him in Fairfax that night. But when the agents go to their house and talk to them, it's clear that especially Brian's uncle just wants them to get the fuck out of his house. So kind of suspicious. Cut then to 1925 in August. White wants his team to basically infiltrate this town of Ralston, where reportedly Anna was seen in her car by some men in front of a hotel before she was killed later on. These witnesses aren't easy to find now, but they're able to track down a farmer and his wife who testified that they saw Anna with Brian Burkhart that night in a car out in front of the hotel. So Brian's alibi is clearly not so rock solid. He lied about just taking Anna back to her house, dropping her off, and then going to whatever this musical is. Clearly, they were seen together later on that night again. So this timeline that we get is basically Brian and Anna stop by a speakeasy and are there until 10 p.m. Then they head to another joint north of Fairfax where Brian's uncle is spotted with them. Brian and Anna are there until about 1 a.m. It's kind of murky where they went next, but some people reported seeing a third man with Anna and Brian when they left that wasn't Brian's uncle. So just another unknown dude with the two of them. Then at 3 a.m., a witness who knows them both, Brian and Anna, said that she'd heard a car stop near her house in Fairfax, where a man whom she believed to be Brian shouted, "Stop your foolishness, Annie, and get into this car." Then there's finally a report that Brian returned home to his house at sunrise. Okay, so who is this third guy? That's kind of what we're trying to figure out. Who else is related to this night before Anna is murdered? Was Brian responsible for this murder? Was he involved in the other murders? We just have more questions now that we need to kind of follow down the line.
Yep, great job relaying that. That's not a necessarily easy chapter to take notes on. It's just kind of very bang, 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 fact, fact, fact. And we do need all of them. Chapter 12, more of this, is titled A Wilderness of Mirrors. Basically, everyone in the investigation, not a fed, is trying to tear the case down. Local and Oklahoma state cops are at best incompetent and at worst totally crooked, and the private eyes are actively obstructing the investigation. White's job is now closer to espionage than it is really even detective work. He's implementing spies and trying to counter other spies and moles. And they get word that Pike, this private eye hired by Hale, knows who the third man was. When they get to him, he eventually confesses that Hale hired him to give a false alibi to protect Brian. And Ernest, Molly Burkhart's husband, is also aware of this. That's where this chapter ends. Very short.
Yeah. One of the most obvious quotes that just sums up everything about these investigations to this point is one of the agents, Berger, just is quoted as saying, "It is quite apparent that there is some crooked work afoot." Oh, yeah, dude.
Yeah, dude. "The principles of detection tell me something is wrong with this investigation." Yeah, fucking turn your brain on, man.
"Some crooked work is afoot."
Maybe that was just like a random line in like a more intelligent sounding paragraph, but also the old timey language. Dude, what are you talking? Of course there is. Why do you think you're here, dude? If this was open and shut, they would have closed this case in 1921. Whatever.
Four years later, everything good here. We just, like, the other people just didn't try hard enough. Anyway, okay, so chapter 13, titled A Hangman's Son. So Gran will do this every once in a while. We'll just, like, break in the narrative and give you some history on a character, the history of some thing that's important to the case. I really like it because it adds some color to things, mm-hmm. but is a departure from the story. So we're going to take a break from the Osage murders, and in this chapter, we're going to talk about the history of Tom White and how he was basically raised in a lawman's home and how that influenced him to eventually become a lawman himself. Mm-hmm. So Tom White saw a criminal hanged first when he was just a boy, and this executioner was his father. So his father, Robert Emmett White, who goes by Emmett, was the sheriff of Travis County, which included the city of Austin. He migrated from Tennessee and started a family with his wife, Maggie. But when Tom was six, his mother died, leaving his dad with five kids, all under the age of 10, to raise by himself. But he was well known and very well respected in the county, which led to him later becoming the sheriff. And he moved his family into the building directly next to the jail, which was filled with murderers, rapists, lunatics, etc. At one point, there's a jailhouse riot that breaks out. All of Emmett's kids, including Tom, run to get help. It's a bloody mess. Afterward, Emmett is described as being kind of an unyielding sheriff. However, he was a pretty forward-thinking guy. Apparently, he didn't see race as an excuse to treat any prisoners worse than any others. He defended black inmates from lynch mobs. And there's a story of, on multiple occasions, he had the younger prisoners stay in his home with his family to protect them from older prisoners who might harm them. And this story was the case of a young girl, and we don't know why she was in prison to begin with. So clearly, Tom's experience and proximity to the law and criminals was very formative to him. He watched his father hunt down killers and rapists. He even saw his father get stabbed in the back in this jail. But back to the beginning of this chapter, Tom witnessed his first execution in 1984 when a 19-year-old black man named Ed Nichols was accused of rape but maintained his innocence. What's kind of crazy about this is the gallows were erected 10 feet from his cell, which was the only place in the prison with a high enough ceiling to build the gallows. But it's just awful thinking about how if you're sitting in jail, you're scared to death, and every day you just hear your death instrument being constructed 10 feet away from you. Okay, so Nichols is appealing, but the governor rejects his final appeal. Nichols asked to be clean shaven and put in a black suit for his execution, and Emmett, Tom's father, honors this wish. So again, kind of a stand-up guy. The execution does not go smoothly. Nichols does not die instantly, and it was that experience that led Tom to oppose what was then sometimes called judicial homicide. So he came to see the law as, quote, as a struggle to subdue the violent passions not only in others, but also in oneself. So this gets to this kind of idea that Tom, even being a Texas Ranger, was always hesitant to pull his gun. He didn't like killing people needlessly. This is the kind of guy that we're talking about. He joins the Texas Rangers in 1905, which was now more or less a state police force after being basically formed to just combat native peoples. His brothers Doc and Dudley also joined, while Tom's brother Coley became the next Travis County sheriff. Tom learned a lot when he joined the Rangers, things like turn over your boots to check for snakes, always wear black so you're, you know, invisible at night, blah, blah, blah. Tom got really good at his job. He and another ranger basically rid a town of crime by themselves.
Hard.
So hard. But throughout this entire time, there's this temptation to play judge, jury, and executioner, where you're a lawman in the Wild West. You don't have a ton of oversight. But Tom's able to resist this temptation for much of his career. Tom tried to settle down with a woman named Bessie, but the job wasn't really allowing for that, kind of a hard job to hold down and be married at the same time. He later witnessed one of his closest friends get murdered by a deputy sheriff in some town that he was sent to go clean up. And after seeing enough violence and death over the course of time in the Rangers, Tom quit. Went to marry Bessie, moved to San Antonio, start a family, became a railroad detective, and later joined the Bureau in 1917. The chapter ends by basically saying, in 1918, Tom's brother Dudley was killed in action hunting down deserters in Texas. So lots of violence, lots of just kind of horrific things in this guy's past. And so it's really interesting, at least to me, that we come out of this chapter understanding this guy as kind of a very measured and, I don't know, I'm hesitant because I haven't read the rest of the book to, you know, call him merciful, but at least he has some moral ground that he's standing on.
I think what's important about this, like you said, especially given how respected and honorable this portrayal of his father was, that Tom White is approaching this with a certain level of experience, mental conditioning to be able to be like, no matter what I see, like I've seen this before. Like you said, it upsets him when he reads a case file, but this is, you know, a little bit of a day in the life for someone with his experience. And also someone with a lack of interpersonal prejudice, which is not something the people of the Osage tribe are experiencing. They're experiencing the exact opposite. They're experiencing extreme prejudice. They're being killed for who they are and what they have. And someone like Tom White is not super common in the 1920s, especially someone in law enforcement. And so I think it's very interesting that, you know, the dominoes falling of history happened to his domino is a very unique character in this time and place in Americans.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, all I'm saying, I guess, is I'm hesitant to just give him my, you know, my vote of approval on everything so far, because as we will learn, Gran has painted some people in this book as being like great dudes, and perhaps they're not.
Yeah. So that's where chapter 14 comes in, titled Dying Words. Tom White is tracking down leads and trying to figure out what Smith, the husband of Rita, who was dynamited, what he knew before him, his wife, and their servant were blown up. The Schoen doctors and Smith's lawyers were present with him and asked the nurse to leave when they had a conversation with him. So there's a little bit of a legal technicality here where so the head rights thing, the oil, basically royalties, they are only inherited. They can't be bought or sold. So when Rita died, everything went to her husband. But if they both died at the same time, everything would go to Molly Burkhart. But what ended up happening was he stayed alive a few more days. And when grilled, the Schoen brothers asked, like, why were you there? Why did you need to be there? They're like, oh, well, we're doctors and we're his friends. Like, okay, well, you were there with his lawyer. Why? Why not members of his family? Why not members of Rita's family? The brothers start collapsing pretty quickly. And especially when they say, like, what did he say? Did he say that he thought anyone was to blame? And they said, oh, no, that's not true. But then when they talk to the lawyer breaks right away. He claims that Smith said that Hale and Ernest were his only enemy. So then they go back to the brothers, who are like, oh, yeah, maybe he did say that. Oh, yeah, I think he may have mentioned William Hale and Ernest Burkhart. So the nurse is then asked by Hale later what she knew about that conversation when the investigators are talking to this nurse. And she said she knew and she wouldn't say anything to him. And it turns out these Schoen, I don't know if I'm saying it right, but I'm just going to keep doing that. These Schoen brothers were appointed to Rita's estate as the White conservators before Smith died. And that's why they were there with his lawyer, because they needed someone who was helping with the estate to take care of that. And they totally fall apart under pressure. So this guardian system is one of like the most egregious forms of racist graft in the history of our country. And like, we really dive back into that. We get a story of an Osage woman's baby dying because her guardian restricted any money for her to withdraw from her bountiful account to feed her children. She ended up destitute and the baby died. And that's kind of what gives more prominent attention to the concept of these white guardianships to Osage people. And there's a really haunting quote towards the end where they say that the guardian system, quote, they are scalping our soul.
Yeah. Yeah. An orgy of graft and exploitation. And before 1925, an estimated $8 million in those days' dollars was pilfered by guardians from their wards' estates. So incredible sums of money are being just stolen from these people because, again, as our guy, Chief Bacon Rind, said before, like, everybody's coming to town to just get a piece of this money. And people are just taking advantage and coming up with these like networks and people are even saying, like, identifying certain Osage people and saying like, oh, let's go after their money next. Let's go after him. Let's go after her. Like, we need a guardian over here. We need a guardian there. Once you get a hold of that money, you buy goods from X, Y, or Z store. you can sell it then back to the Osage person whose money it is that you're actually using at like a premium. It's all just a crazy big racket. It's ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, props to White for recognizing, hey, the people in the room when Bill Smith was dying, props to them for being like, hey, if you went to see what Bill knew about his killers and all you took with you was these doctors who seemed to be like involved in all of this somehow.
Right.
And an attorney, but not a sheriff. What's going on here? And that gets us into chapter 15, The Hidden Face. So our undercover insurance agent operative learned from a woman when trying to buy a house that William Hale runs everything around here. And he even set his own pastures ablaze for insurance money. So he ran in an insurance fraud scheme that netted him $30K when he burnt up his own pastures. We also learned that Hale was the beneficiary of Henry Rowan's $25,000 life insurance policy, but that was never investigated after Henry Rowan died. This policy was pushed for by Hale. He even paid a larger premium to this agency to get the payout higher. So in order to be a beneficiary, you have to be a family member or a creditor of that person. And White didn't actually believe that Rowan owed Hale really anything, and certainly not $25,000. And proof of this debt was never actually provided to the first insurance agent that they speak to try and take out this policy. Rowan himself was not in good health. He was an alcoholic, so this policy wasn't going to be easy to come by, because nobody's going to insure a guy who is like really flirting with death as it is. So Hale had to get like a private doctor to create some sham medical recommendation. And of course, one of these doctors he goes to was one of the Schoen brothers. So this first application for this life insurance policy gets rejected. Hale ends up going to another agency. This time he does provide a creditor slip, but this debt has inexplicitly risen from the original amount of $10,000 to $25,000. This credit slip was signed by Rowan and predated the application, but we get this background on document and handwriting analysis where this French criminologist, Bertillon, kind of pioneered like analyzing handwriting and different document analysis. And so what ended up happening was they handed over this creditor slip to an expert at the Treasury Department who was able to conclude the date of the credit slip had been changed from June to read Janny, as in January. So funny stuff is going on with this. Finally, Hale takes Rowan to a doctor for his exam, and the doctor asked Hale if he was going to, quote, kill this Indian. And laughing, Hale said, hell yes. So after Rowan's funeral, local lawmen, in addition to ignoring Hale as a suspect, tried to build a case against this other guy, Roy Bunch, the man who'd been sleeping around with Rowan's wife. Hale himself approached Bunch and told him he should get out of town because people think he killed Rowan. Then Hale visited Rowan's widow to get her to sign papers regarding claims against Rowan's estate. And he left a bottle of whiskey for her, but smartly, she didn't drink it, fearing that it was poisoned. Okay, so now we have enough links, basically, between Hale and Rowan to make White suspect, but have no proof that Hale is involved with all of these murders. But he doesn't exactly know what the motive would be, and he doesn't have any kind of tie between the different killings. But Cody hinted at this when he was going over chapter 14. One thing stood out. With these headrights, as Cody said, you can't get them by buying them. And Hale tried his best to do that. But with that not being legal, all that's left is going through inheritance in probate. So with more and more people dying, Molly Burkhart has become the inheritor of more and more of these headrights. And she just happens to be married to Ernest Burkhart, the nephew and lapdog of William Hale. So clearly there's an order now of how these things are, how these deaths and murders were planned out. So first we have Anna, who's divorced and has no kids and left her head right to her mother, Lizzie. Then Lizzie dies, splitting her head right between her daughters, Molly and Rita. Then Rita and her husband, Bill, their house is exploded with dynamite. And here's where this issue that Cody mentioned comes into play. Because Bill survived a few days after, part of the stipulation in Rita's will meant that her part of her head right would pass to Bill unless they died simultaneously. But the bulk of her head right still went to Molly, whose money was controlled by Ernest, her husband. So the question is, was Ernest's marriage to Molly ever legit? Because he was married to her for 4 years before any of this started. Or was it always this long con to get at her money? And I love this because this chapter ends with this quote from Shakespeare. Where wilt thou find a cavern dark enough to mask thy monstrous visage? Seek none conspiracy, hide it in smiles and affability. Dude, Hale and Ernest, painted as like upstanding dudes, friends of the Osage, all of a sudden we're just like, these dudes are absolutely involved in this.
The worst part about this for me is that the realization that Hale and Ernest have been cooking this up the whole time took like a month of busy work and basic like detective shit to figure out. They had 4 years. So they obviously knew like, hey, wait a minute. This is going to look so sketchy. We have to pay off all the Pinkertons and bribe the cops and get these fucking Schoen brothers, maybe the worst doctors we've ever had on the show. Of all right. the bad doctor segments we have, we may have to like name it like the Schoen brother honorary bad doctor segment.
Yeah, dude.
The second a group of serious people with no visible prejudices came on the scene, they're like, oh yeah, these guys. It's fucking them the whole time.
And that's the whole idea, because previously, it's not just that the law enforcement and PIs that were in Osage were doing their job poorly. A lot of them were doing their jobs very well. It's just that their jobs were to make this crime disappear.
Exactly.
Like make it super complicated, really hard to figure out, create all of these loose end leads, no evidence, and just make it confusing. So it's likely that if you didn't cut through any of that just corruption with like a federal agency coming in, this would be unsolved. Today, like that's probably what ends up happening.
Crazy.
Let's get right into highs and lows, positives, negatives. I'm just going to start. That last chapter, chapter 15, was so good, where it was like the perfect amount of just, you know, it's just, it reads like a mystery novel where he's like, So follow the money and then investigate what each of these wills look like and how this money kind of trails down.
Mm-hmm.
And any good mystery, in my opinion, also has a semi-complicated or well-thought-out bad guy plan.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this is like as patient and diabolical as it is it just makes the light bulb moment for Tom White that much more rewarding.
Yeah, so my negative is actually the next step in that, realizing it for me. I'll come up with a different one for variety, but I think that's also my highlight of the week, is like all those kind of like pieces clicking together. But then when the pieces click together, you're like, I should have seen this coming. Why do we believe these guys at face value? When they're like, oh yeah, I love the Osage people. I'm not here for any money. Okay, well, why are you there then? Like to live in a like oil place where you can't grow or ranch anything, but you don't have access to the oil money. Okay.
So this is why, you know, we said at the beginning when we started reading this book, this is nonfiction. But what Gran is doing is so similar to what Agatha Christie did in her novel, where it's like, we're going to present you with all of this data and like red herrings so that you can't just see through it right away.
Right.
There was no reason for Gran to like add a little color about Hale and calling him, you know, a friend of the Osage people, just to go back and say, like, actually, he wasn't so friendly, other than to basically make this a more interesting read.
Mm-hmm.
So I also was just like hitting my head against a wall, being like, you idiot. The only guy in here that has a nickname like the King of the Osage Hills. Maybe not great.
No, not good.
Like, come on, dude. Like, open your eyes. Read a book.
What are you going to do? So that was my low of the week. But my high of the week, you know, the light bulb moment was great. For sake of variety, got to go with the Ocean's 11, but it's Western dudes. That was so sick.
Yeah, it was awesome.
I don't know. Made me want to, like, book a time to ride a horse or something. I don't know. Just happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that Gran included some details on, for example, that Agent Berger, right? He mentions that some of these agents have to be out in the open because they're well known enough in the territory that they can't be undercover. And so, again, there's like this mixture of, you know, espionage, but also just defiance in the face of clear danger, just entering this town saying, yes, I'm in charge of this investigation. This is my right hand man, Berger. And like, people are just going to follow us around, maybe shoot at us. Like, it was such a cool chapter.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've given your positive and negative. My negative this week is, honestly, this is hard for me because coming off the end of this book, I was like just loving it so much that I had a hard time like coming up with one that I like with something that I didn't like about this.
Yeah, we're picking nits.
I think part of what is annoying reading a book like this, and again, this gets back to the Agatha Christie thing, there's a lot of detail about leads that go nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can imagine somebody listening to this is trying to like keep up and think like, Rose Osage, is that person important? Well, she's important in illustrating the fact that like evidence and testimony has been manufactured by people. But in order to like follow the actual case, she doesn't help with anything.
No.
And so while reading this book, going through it, I'm just, especially after the revelation that William Hale and Ernest Burkhart aren't actually good dudes, I'm just kind of like, okay, so what leads are we tracking down that are actually going to be worthwhile? Again, not purely a negative, but picking nits.
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, so next time we're going to finish up Chronicle 2. So just reading to the end of this section of the book. Looking forward to that. We're going to split this book into basically four episodes. So we're finishing Chronicle 2 next time, and then we'll finish out the book the week after that. And then Cody and I will independently go and see Killers of the Flower Moon in theaters, which I am like, I'm struggling
at the bit.
I'm struggling not to just go see it now.
Yeah, it's taking a lot of willpower. I'm only hearing good things. I'm chomping at the bit.
Yeah, yeah. So excited for that. But until next time, hit us up on Instagram at Bibliotakes. Send us an email with your thoughts on any of this. Bibliotakes@gmail.com. And we will see you all next time.
Talk soon, folks.